This is Bronwyn Schwagert, licensed therapist and author at the Angry at the Right Things podcast. Instead of controlling our anger, we'll be looking at what causes it in the first place so we can rectify what's dysfunctional in our lives and in the world. Here we go. Back to Angry at the Right Things. This is Bronwyn and this is
Katie.
And we are here to talk about perception today. We've talked a lot about borderline personality disorder or BPD / narcissism, which are one and the same, especially malignant narcissism. And today we're going to talk more about like a meta theme, which is perception, because it really is all about perception.
I agree.
Okay. So I want to start off with an archetype that we, most of us might be familiar with, maybe not everyone. It's an archetype actually from the Bible. Some people believe it's literal, but a lot of people, even if those people think it is literal, also see that it has a figurative aspect to it, a figurative, communication where it's trying to communicate something about the nature of humans. And so I want to talk about Adam and Eve and them being in the Garden of Eden, and specifically Eve and how she was deceived by the snake. So again, you don't have to be religious to go along with this. You can think of it as a myth that has meaning, that has a moral to it, and is intended to communicate something about the nature of humans. So I recently was listening to this particular myth in a different light, and I thought about it as, you know, it says that when Eve took the fruit, a lot of times people think it's an apple, but it just says fruit that was forbidden, that she said her eyes would be opened and that her eyes were opened. And so when our eyes are opened, we see things differently. In fact, we see everything differently. Right. So she had a different perspective. But if you look into this narrative, which is in the book of Genesis in the Hebrew scriptures, Eve actually, her perspective changed way before she took the fruit.
Really?
Yes. So in the narrative, basically there's a snake talking to her. And guys, ancient civilizations did not believe that talking snakes were normal. They didn't have like a worldview for that being a normal thing. And so she's in the garden, and she, we don't believe, was alone at the time, but it's kind of the narrative sets it up that she is alone. And all of a sudden there's a snake talking to her, and he's asking her, he starts with a question, and he says, "Did God really say that you can't eat any of the fruit in this garden?" And Eve responds to this talking snake stranger saying, "Oh no, 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 that's not true. Actually, there's only one tree of which we cannot eat." Oh, this is what she doesn't say. But I think she thought, why is there one tree that I can't eat from? Why is God holding out this fruit that looks so delicious from this one tree? So her perspective starting to change just by this talking snake's power of suggestion, like, did God really say, kind of thing? And she's like, there is this one tree and we can't eat it. And I wonder if God's holding out on us and what's up. And then her perspective actually changes, and she goes ahead and she does eat of the fruit of that tree at the snake's suggestion. But guys, if you read the narrative, if you read this story, her perception changes way before the fruit. Her eyes are opened way before she consumes the fruit. And if you look up the word perception, the root, the etymology of the word, the sept part or the sieve part, perceive or perception, that root is a really ancient Euro-Indo what is it? Proto-Indo-European root. And it's actually the same word. Well, it's the word cap. It can be spelled with a K or a C. K-A-P or C-A-P. And cap means to take, to grasp, or to seize.
Okay.
And so per means in the Latin thorough. So she thoroughly takes a different look at reality. She has thoroughly grasped a different reality in a different light. So her perception has changed. And it's very interesting because she grasps a different notion of reality from the snake's suggestion. Then she takes the forbidden fruit and eats it. And then she becomes actually taken because the word cap, remember, is the root word there. Captive, the word captive comes from that root, which means taken or grasped or seized. And you can argue the narrative is trying to portray it as she herself, as well as Adam, who is also taking the fruit and eating it, become captives.
So her new perception in turn took hold of her view on reality.
Like her new perception of this new kind of freedom that was kind of insinuated from this talking snake, instead of becoming free, she becomes captive. But yes, the perception leads to her losing whatever freedom she once had.
Right.
Yeah. So I thought that's a really interesting thing. And I thought today we could talk about perception in general, because it's very, very important. So I want to talk about something I wrote, which are all people are beasts. What kind of beast are you? I think I'm a dog.
A dog?
Are you a cat, dog, mouse?
Gosh. I think I'm kind of like, I sort of identify with sloths, unfortunately.
Oh, that's sweet.
But yeah, maybe a cat.
Cat. Mm-hmm. Sloths seem like, I would like a pet sloth. Like they seem very cuddly.
Yeah.
And not just kind of dangerous.
Hanging around.
Yeah. I mean, we might be wrong, but.
Yeah, I don't really know too much about them.
But they seem very cuddly from whatever I've seen.
Yeah, or maybe like a koala.
Okay. So people are beasts, and we're the fun beasts, like I'm a dog and Katie's a koala. But there's other beasts like parasites and predators. So let's just talk about those categories, because we've been talking a lot about BPD, borderline personality folks, and then malignant narcissists. But let's talk about parasites and predators, because they're all one and the same. And if you listen to my last couple podcasts on borderline personality folks, you learned a lot that they are looking for someone to nurture them. So they are very parasitic in that way. They're looking for a host, or they're looking for prey, right?
Something to feed on.
Yes. They depend on others to feed them in some way. So all of my clients are either prey or hosts for predators or parasites. I have one client who, when she heard me reflect that her parents are like parasites, she actually was really, it really opened her eyes. And she said, you know, I have always been terrified of leeches my entire life, like a very strong like reaction, a phobia. And she said, I think now I know why, because they really represent my parents. And they use people. So what they have in common, predators and parasites, they use people. They relate to people like objects. They objectify people. And what they really want is for their narcissistic supply to be met from the people that they are objectifying. And so that can be, like we've been talking about BPD, they want others to meet their narcissistic supply by nurturing them in some way. But it can also be someone to dominate, someone to control, someone to humiliate, to subjugate, or to self-validate, like through sex. So if I think you're good looking and you have sex with me, then you have just been a mirror for me, giving me the validation of myself, that kind of thing. Some parasites self-define as victims. I'm sure you guys are familiar with those parasites. And anyone who challenges them is just a bully, and they're always an innocent victim. But truly, those victims are the passive-aggressive bullies themselves, because it's all about power. It is all a power play. I help my clients see the game, and that is the first step, and it's 90% of the victory. You just see the patterns. You know they're not coincidental. You know you're not crazy and it's not all in your head. So, for example, when you cook dinner for your mother just after finally moving out on your own, and her somehow always finding just a little thing to find fault with, like complaining about indigestion, that's part of the game. That's not a coincidence. Or when your family always likes to bring up your ex and how much they miss him and how lovely of a person he was. No, that's part of the game. Or when you invite your friend on the vacation that you planned and she complains about the expense of every meal and every Uber ride, etc. Know that that's not just who she is. It's actually a subtle form of sabotage in order for her to feel more powerful, knowing that you planned the trip. Know that when your parents continue to ask for money, it's about way more than money. It's about power. Every master needs a slave. In order to feel superior, someone else needs to be made inferior. It's narcissistic supply, and nothing is more threatening to the slave master than the slave who is independent and doing very well for herself. Any thoughts from the koala?
Not yet.
Okay. What is the most powerful of all, however, is our perspective. A perspective that's based in reality, that's willing to embrace reality at all costs, even if what she sees is not beautiful. Your perspective is your power. If your eyes are open and you see those patterns, you, my friend, are the one in power. Because BPDs, malignant narcissists, parasites, predators, whatever you want to call them, they all have this one thing in common. Here we go. Mm-hmm. They need you more than you need them. They will never allow you to know this, of course, and they're actively in denial of this to themselves as well. But it's true. So when you get savvy and you give them an ultimatum or you call them out on what's really going on, that's when they get scared. But remember, every parasite needs a host. The predators without their prey are going to starve. So you're going to see a visceral reaction. But first, let's talk more about perspective, because there are really only two perspectives to have on the world and on human relationships. The first is transactional, hierarchical, and sees power as inherently limited. So it's always a competition to gain and to keep power. It's always a dog-eat-dog kind of world. This tends to be the unconscious or conscious, sometimes, perspective of the narcissist or the BPD, as they've never successfully achieved that very fundamental developmental stage of trust. Remember Eric Erickson, trust versus mid-trust develops in the first year and a half of life. So if you have never developed trust because you've never had a consistently trustworthy caregiver at your core, you have never learned that humans are trustworthy, and you will ascribe to this view where power is a zero-sum game.
That is so interesting. That really helps me understand many people that I know that view the world so differently than I do. I really struggle with people that I see as being status oriented mm-hmm. in their lives.
Yeah.
And I don't really relate to that. And I tend to judge it quite a bit.
Yeah.
But this helps me kind of see them in a more kind of objective and compassionate light in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's okay. I guess I don't agree with viewing life that way, but it helps me to understand why people are that way.
So are you referring to what social scientists call conspicuous consumption, like the people who want the really nice car and they want the nice clothes and they have to look really good?
Or they need the degree from the Ivy League college and they need their children to equally follow in their footsteps and do things that they can brag about to their friends and family and see their children as extensions of themselves.
Yeah.
And it just goes and goes and it never ends.
It never ends, and it's never enough.
Never enough. Yeah.
It's never enough. And I was telling you before we did this podcast, I used to ascribe a lot more to this worldview unconsciously. And I was telling you how when I was in grad school, my first graduate program when I was younger, I went to counseling. And I remember telling the counselor, you know, it just feels like no matter how great an essay I write, you know, and how much my professor likes me or whatever, it's never enough. And it only feels good for like an hour or a day at most. And then I feel compelled to do more, and it's never enough.
Yeah. It's like a black hole.
It's a black hole and you never feel satisfied or full. You never feel full. It's like you're always hungry.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So it's not a fun way to view the world.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So it's a competition. So you're not okay to share power when that's your unconscious or implicit worldview. And you're not okay to share attention either. It's kind of the same thing, right?
Right.
Because attention is power.
Yes. So true.
Why did your eyes just light up like that?
Oh, I think I just immediately thought about children. And how children want attention. Above all, they want attention.
Children need attention.
They need attention.
Yes, from their parents.
And they need it and they want it. And they will try to get it any way they can.
That's
right. So even bad attention
is
better than no attention.
Yes. So,
and if that proceeds into adulthood, that's pretty problematic, right?
Then you're dealing with an adult toddler, which we've been talking a lot about.
Yeah.
My mom, bad attention was good attention for her. And like I, looking back, I'm like, oh, that's why she always wanted to pick a fight, because it was a way to get kind of an attunement or an attention. It was like the only kind of communication or interaction that she felt that felt safe for her.
It was a kind of validation. Right?
Or it's a kind of like human connection that felt safe. It doesn't feel vulnerable, but it gives her that connection.
You're paying attention to me, right?
Yes.
You're focused on me.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I exist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She never unlearned that. And there's a lot of adults just like that. So yes, power, when I say power, it can just be attention.
Right.
Not just money.
No.
But attention.
Attention.
Yeah. Yeah. And you see a lot of that. So you can't, if you're like this, if you come from this implicit viewpoint or perspective, you cannot be happy for others when they're celebrating, because it feels threatening,
right?
It feels threatening. So when Katie, who's my bestie, is doing really well for herself, I can say, Wow, it's great. You're doing so well, Katie. Yeah. And you know I'm full of shit because right. it's threatening. I don't like it.
Yeah.
And it's sad because it's a competition. Unfortunately, this happens with our own children when this is our implicit perspective. Unless we see our children as extensions of ourselves, where they have to do well all the time because they're reflecting back to us our value. But a lot of these types, these BPDs, when their children are doing well, they feel jealous and it's a competition. And so they'll find that put down as well.
Right.
Like the mom who, when her daughter finally moves out and has her over for a meal, is like, oh, I have indigestion. Do you have anything for an upset tummy? You know?
Right.
So that's that. You can't really celebrate others because when you are celebrating others because they're mirroring your worth and value, you're really just celebrating yourself.
Right.
The other perspective, so let's move to the happy one,
yeah.
is that power can be shared and should be shared, actually.
And isn't limited.
Right? Isn't limited. That power is not limited. And this, guys, is the underpinning of democracy. Where everyone, at least in theory, has a voice, where everyone, at least in theory, matters. This perspective trusts that when I help someone else, we both benefit. When I make the world a better place, it feels good for me and for others. This perspective knows that power is never a zero-sum game, but that power can grow as it's being shared, that power is something to be leveraged and is good for all. These people have learned as young children that humans are indeed trustworthy. Not all of them, but they can be trusted. And the nature of relationships is not transactional, as in tit for tat, but mutual.
Right.
So something I really want to say, though, is guys, on any given day, I still struggle with the first one. Like, you know, sharing with you when I'm going to be honest, when I see a beautiful woman, I feel threatened and I have to remind myself, okay, Bronwyn, she can be beautiful and you can be beautiful. Like, it's not a competition. Right. We can both be beautiful. So I need to,
it's not either or.
It's right? not an either
it
or.
It can be yes and, right?
It's a yes and. Mm. You know what? That if anyone's ever taken, improv classes, you learn
right.
yes.
It's like the core philosophy.
It's the core philosophy from improv. Yes and.
And improv is collaborative, right?
It's like, totally collaborative. To be a team player, you need to be a yes and kind of person. So one mark of a predator or a parasite or a BPD / malignant narcissist is they don't use their words. They refuse to. Instead, they expect others to read their mind and then meet their unarticulated needs or attune to their unspoken feelings. They do things like insinuate or act passive aggressively or give the silent treatment or suddenly blow up when you apparently fail to guess correctly what they're thinking or feeling. They expect you to be responsible for their feelings and they refuse to be responsible for their own. Oh, and they can never be wrong. That's a clue, guys.
Right. Why do you think that is such a hallmark of this?
It is a hallmark.
Not using your words and expecting other people.
It's a refusal to be vulnerable.
Okay.
Because vulnerability is paired with shame. So if you never learn that humans can be trusted, you can't be vulnerable and you can't trust them when you are vulnerable because they will shame you. So it all kind of goes together.
That makes sense.
So being wrong is a type of vulnerability.
Right.
So you have to defend. Right. You're never wrong because that's too vulnerable because you'll be shamed.
That makes sense.
Right. So these people are always just innocent victims, even when they rage at you or say cruel quips or publicly shame you, they're still just innocent victims because you're the one who made them do those things. They will divide, divide, divide. this is how you know them. At your workplace, there's division. Where's the BPD? In your home, there's division. Who's the BPD in your home? There will never be peace or unity or true collaboration or a true team with everyone being a team member who's equal if there's a BPD predator parasite on board. So let's talk about how we protect ourselves from these folks, because Katie, you shared this with me that mm-hmm. you wanted to hear more about what we can do in response.
Yeah, absolutely.
So first and foremost, you need to know there's this invisible boundary, a feelings boundary, where your feelings are yours alone. My feelings belong to me alone. I alone am responsible for my feelings. Katie and Katie alone is responsible for her feelings. So remember, a BPD will try to outsource their feelings to you. They will try to make you feel responsible for their feelings. If you hold fast and you say, wait, you're responsible for your feelings. I'm responsible for my feelings. Your feelings belong to you. You don't have to say this out loud. Mentally, if you say it to yourself, you just stand firm and you're like, hey, this isn't working. Mm-hmm. Not working. Okay, so that's number one. Any thoughts on that?
No, I think that pretty much says it.
Number two, remind yourself that grown-ups use their words. This is not too much to ask or expect. Your job is to never read anyone else's mind, but to respond to their actual requests or comments when and if they decide to be a grown-up and use their words. Okay. Number three, and this is a big one, be a mirror. What the BPDs cannot tolerate is a true reflection of themselves. You can just narrate what's happening as you engage with them to give them a true reflection of themselves. You can say, huh, John, I see that you're rolling your eyes right now in a way to communicate your disapproval. That's supposed to make me give in to you. Well, that's not going to happen. You like that?
Yeah.
It's fun. I like that. Really enjoy this part. I have to admit, I'm very sarcastic. Sarcasm, you guys, is so powerful. We'll talk about that in a minute. We can say, wow, you're 54 and you still haven't learned not to shame people into doing what you want. Wow, that's hard to believe. So that's a mirror.
Yeah.
Or you could say, I'm hearing that you are trying to detract away from what I just said by attempting to provoke me to feel guilt. That's not going to work. I'm just going to repeat my original statement now, and I'd like you to respond to the original statement and stop just detracting away.
Right. It's pretty much just saying it how it is, right?
You're a narrator.
Yeah.
Your job is to be a third party narrator, narrating what's going on.
Yeah.
And you're a mirror. And then sarcasm, my favorite. Use sarcasm to communicate. And this is good for those little quips a BPD will make to bring you down or humiliate you. My mother-in-law, I want to say God bless her, but I'm not going to say that. She used to always do this publicly whenever her family with me included, would get together. She'd always find a public way to humiliate me. It would be like one per event.
Right.
Looking back, I wish that I knew what I know now, because she's now deceased. So I wished I could go back in time and I would have said, oh, is this the time of our family gathering where Connie publicly humiliates Bronwyn? Big smile. Sarcasm. So what this does is it communicates to that person that their venomous quip doesn't work because you're happy and you're smiling. And the sarcasm is like showing it doesn't penetrate. So it loses its power. It's disarming, but I'm not attacking her either. I'm not saying, fuck you, Connie. Like, I'm not doing that. I'm just, I'm just being sarcastic, and I like that. It holds up a mirror to that person that they cannot withstand.
Right.
And I could say something like, wow, Connie, I'm not feeling the holiday spirit right now. What's going on?
Yeah. Well, it's like you're saying something that they can't possibly refute because yeah. you're calling them out directly for what they're doing in yeah. that moment.
Yeah. And it's disarming, and it actually can make everyone laugh. I honestly think it would have made her laugh had I right. done that.
Right.
Which would have been a win-win.
Yeah.
It would have stopped her from doing it, and it would have made everyone laugh because it's so tense when someone does that. I think everyone's just like, you know, everyone's just kind of like in shock.
Yeah.
And to make a joke out of it is like the perfect way to facilitate that, right. you know? Like,
yeah.
It's the perfect antidote. So sarcasm, humor. Next, document the patterns for yourself, to give yourself a mirror of this person's true nature. You need to document into words on a Google Doc or whatever your very experiences of their belittling, their passive aggressiveness, their manipulation. Document every single incident that comes to mind, past and present, and share it with someone who you trust and who can validate you so they can be a mirror for you. But most importantly, you need to use your document as a mirror if you are still engaging with this person. Before you engage and after, you need to go over this document in a way that manages your expectations, because our minds love to forget or dissociate from the hard truth of who people really are. And our minds will play tricks on us. And we can't afford that to happen because we will become depressed or anxious. We will be compromised in our mental health. So the document we do is for ourselves, to remind ourselves, to give ourselves a reality check of what to expect before we engage with this person.
That's a really good tip.
That's what I did for myself with my father. Okay. Share some or all of these incidents with that person. You can do this. I recommend hold them accountable with an email. You can preface the email with, this is a unilateral piece of communication, and if you respond to it, I will not read it. I will delete it. This is just an accounting to set the record straight, nothing more. I will not get swept into an argument or any type of communication. This is one way. So you can do that. I want to share an example I shared with you.
Yeah.
Maybe a month and a half ago. Yeah,
this is pretty profound.
Profound. So there, I was at a Christmas party with a friend I hadn't seen in like a year or two. And she had a mutual friend or a friend over that I'd never met before. She was a lovely woman. She was from Brazil originally. And she was sharing, we started talking about borderline personality disorder people. And she really was pretty convinced that her mother-in-law was BPD. And she was a really bold woman, the woman I met. And she was telling me that she actually confronted the mother-in-law one time in person and actually relayed 11 different things this mother-in-law had done or said that she wanted to hold her accountable for. And she like went through every single one with her face to face. The mother-in-law did not respond. And this mother-in-law isn't that old, like, and she's super healthy. She's like a health fanatic. She goes into a coma that night. The mother had never had that experience before or since. She'd never been hospitalized. Like, again, she was very healthy. She had no pre-existing conditions. She went into a coma for like 4 days, where she was lying in the hospital unresponsive, but her eyes were open. So I've never heard of a coma where someone's eyes are open. Her eyes were open, but she wasn't seeing anyone right. or responding to anyone.
Like she was catatonic.
She was catatonic. I don't think that was a coma. I think that was misdiagnosis. I think she was in what we call a dissociative episode. I think she dissociated in response to these 11 facts, these 11 like examples that she couldn't like defend herself from her daughter-in-law. And I think she dissociated for about 4 days and she's recovered, but that was her response. So guys, this is powerful. You're not going to kill anyone, but they might enter what we call a dissociative state or even a dissociative fugue. But that's because you're breaking through their denial.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? That's the craziest thing.
It is crazy.
Yeah. This I just thought of recently. I do this with my clients. So an imagination exercise, imagine this person in your mind's eye. Let your imagination go wild and really depict them as they really are, knowing what you really know about them. What do you see? Do you picture a snake, a Venus flytrap, a dragon, a monster, a leech, a hurricane? What do you see? Now that you've allowed yourself to see them as they really are, that's really powerful. That's part of your perspective that gives you power to not expect them to be human when you engage with them. So you're not surprised and you're not taken unaware. And then finally, an ultimatum. So I'm going to give the example of what I did with my own father. I confronted him with an email that documented not everything, but a number of things of his past abuse that continues today. And he refuses to recognize. And I wrote, "I love you too much to allow you to continue to hurt us both. You're 80% monster, and you can't slay a monster that you won't acknowledge." And I told him that in order to continue our relationship, I need to trust that he will be a safe person. And until he demonstrates this, starting but not ending with an apology, I can't be in his life because I don't trust him to be consistently a safe person. And it's sad. I haven't spoken to him in almost a year now, coming up on a year, but I have never felt better or slept better. And I struggled with insomnia for 30 years, like literally 30 years. So it's sad, but it's a good sad.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like corny, but sort of like, I guess that's what you call tough love, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, it is. It's tough love. It really is. Yeah. You know, it is. Tough love is love, because enabling people to be monsters or parasites or predators is not loving.
No.
You're not loving that person and you're not loving yourself. There's nothing loving about enabling. There's having grace for people and then there's enabling. And those are two distinct things. So when Katie does something to hurt me, I have grace for her. But when Katie starts demonstrating a pattern that repeats over and over, it's not gracious to just keep ignoring it. Now I'm enabling.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So I want to share something else. I didn't share this with you beforehand. This is an essay I wrote yesterday morning. And it's, again, about perspective. And it's called Storm Riding. When I was camping, this is a true story, when I was camping with my husband in Colorado last summer, we pitched a tent in a beautiful but exposed location. I'd made the reservations in advance, and we found our site was a hilltop site, which gave us a gorgeous view of a nearby lake and rolling green hillsides, but also exposed us to the elements, as there weren't even any trees for cover. It was sunny and peaceful when we drove in to set up camp around 5 p.m., and it remained that way until about 9 p.m. when the sun started setting, but then it started raining, and at the time, we were happy to be snug and warm in our sleeping bags in our tent, but then around 10:30 p.m., just as we're falling off to sleep, the wind picks up, like loud wind, and the rain really started coming down, and it became a full full-fledged storm. And since that tent material is actually made out of the same material as a sail for a boat, you can imagine that our tent really wanted to become airborne at that time. So my husband yelled for me to hold down one of the corner pegs, and yelled is what he had to do over the sound of the wind. Yeah. And we're like this far away from each other, pretty much. I was scared, and it seemed fruitless to fight the storm. Our tent threatened to cave in on itself with us inside. So while we held down the tent pegs, I couldn't see a thing because the tent walls were billowing around my head. I remember how helpless I felt, and I wanted to give up. But Steve yelled for me just to hold still and confront the storm, maintaining a tiny bit of order in the face of chaos. Order that was impossible for me to even see at the time or to even imagine, as all my senses received were the messages of chaos. The wind was intimidating and so loud, and the feel of it was so powerful. My biggest worry was, how long will this last? What if it rages all night? Or even what if it rages for another hour? If it does, and we have to surrender and pull up our tent, all the nearby hotels will be closed and we'll forego an entire night of sleep. And this is my vacation. So despair was at the door of my tent knocking persistently, or my mind knocking persistently. Turns out the intensity of the storm only lasted 40 minutes or so, and we were able to sleep peacefully the rest of the night. But truth be told, I did worry another storm would sweep through at 3 a.m. to rob me of my rest. It didn't, and the next morning was sunny and warm and peaceful, and you would have never known that even happened. I remember thinking while we were driving through the beautiful Colorado countryside the next day, if someone had just told me, Bronwyn, this storm is going to rage, but it's only going to rage for 40 minutes. And once it's over, everything will be calm and safe the rest of the night. I would have been so happy just to hold down the tent peg for those 40 minutes. I would not have lost hope. And that would have made all the difference. You see, what the storms in life do best and worst is mess with our minds and our hearts. People can tell us they're only temporary, and they can say things like, this too will pass, but we don't really believe them because they don't actually know it to be true. And whatever storm they're referencing that they've gone through is not the same as your storm, and you know it. There's no guarantee it will ever be over without permanent damage and destruction. Or that you'll even survive. There's no guarantee the sun will ever come out for you again. I know this from experience, and I know how obnoxious it is for people to try to talk you out of your storm experience or to try to force upon you some kind of false hope. I know what it feels like to want to give in to a storm and just let it kill you. I know what it's like to kill yourself too. Been there, done that. I know what it's like to be fresh out of hope and what that will tempt you to do. And I know how easy it is to give up fighting the chaos of the storm, fighting to maintain some type of order that seems utterly impossible. You see, my last storm nearly killed me. But now I have a new vantage point. This doesn't mean I'd ever want to repeat the past, but it does mean that in retrospect, the prolonged storm of hopelessness and chaos taught me something I will never forget, and that even makes me powerful. You see, no one can teach us wisdom. Wisdom only comes from experiential learning and can't be taught with some kind of discomfort or even all-out pain. And wisdom makes us powerful because it changes how we see things. It teaches us to see things from a mountaintop where nothing is hidden from us, not even hope. Wisdom gives us a reconnaissance that helps us see patterns and correctly manage our expectations. our eyes are opened and what we see looks different, even though for all intents and purposes, nothing's changed. But to us, everything has changed. In retrospect, my very severe depressive episodes taught me so much. They taught me far more than any graduate program in counseling psychology ever could. In fact, I could now teach a class on depression myself. I learned that depression doesn't come out of nowhere, and there's always a trigger. And that trigger is nearly always a betrayal of some type from someone we trusted to attune to us who failed us when we needed them. I learned that the deepest root of depression stems from when we betray ourselves by pretending the person didn't betray us or isn't betraying us and pretending things are okay. Or when we blame ourselves entirely for something we're not entirely responsible for. In retrospect, I learned to embrace reality at all costs. I learned to connect with my anger at others and to no longer bury it. I learned to channel that anger in healthy ways, such as boundaries and assertive statements like, that's not true, or that's not okay, or this needs to change. I learned my anger is valid and it's there to inform my actions and give me wisdom. In the process, I learned that I am not inherently shameful, that sometimes I'm a contributor to the problem, but sometimes the problem is entirely someone else. I learned that it's not my responsibility to please everyone else. I learned that feelings matter, including my own. I learned to give myself the approval and the attunement and the validation that I long for instead of expecting it from others, because even the best of them will indeed fail me. And now that's okay too. Everything I learned allows me to help others ride out their storms, fighting against the chaos to create order. I learned from my own decade-long storm. I'm glad it's over, but I know that it won't be my last. But I'm not afraid of them anymore. I've learned to become a storm rider and even a storm tamer. Bring on the storms, I say, because there is nothing like the sunlight breaking through the clouds and you're still standing. There's nothing like a new day.
That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
I love it. That's awesome.
It really is.
That's incredible.
My own experience. And I just want to encourage everyone listening to this, guys, perspective is powerful. And you can be a storm rider and even a storm tamer. And you can create some beauty and order in this world and do damage to the chaos. You really can.
I love it.
Well, thank you. And I think we're done for today. All right. Thanks for listening, guys. Thanks for tuning in.